I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion that someone would bring a vacate motion. We are simply here trying to do our job. It is not helpful to the cause. It is not helpful to the country. It has not helped the House Republicans advance our agenda, which is in the best interest of the American people here, a secure border, sound governance. And it's not helpful to the unity that we have in the body. I am not concerned about this. I am going to do my job.
House Speaker Mike Johnson speaking to reporters yesterday about the looming threat that he could be ousted if he brings up a bill to aid Ukraine. Johnson has been facing pressure from all sides, with moderate Republicans, Democrats, and foreign leaders urging action, and hard right members of his own party threatening to vote him out if he does. While Johnson has promised a series of aid votes this week, it remains unclear if he can deliver and keep his job. Katie Edmondson covers Congress for the New York Times, and she's been closely following this ongoing fight. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, after months of pressure to act, Johnson has promised to bring four separate aid packages to the House floor, one for Ukraine, one for Israel, one for Taiwan, and then kind of a grab bag in the fourth, which includes conditions for aid plus, weirdly, a TikTok ban. Why did he do that? Why did he separate it all out like that?
That's right. Well, one of the reasons he was resisting calls to pass some sort of foreign aid package for months was that the issue of sending aid to Ukraine continues to be toxic, a political non-starter for much of his conference, many of the conservative lawmakers in the House Republican conference. He's added this, it's called a sidecar, he's added this fourth grab bag piece of legislation in an effort to try to appease some of those Republicans, saying, look, I understand that you might not like the fact that I am putting Ukraine aid to a vote on the House floor, but here are some policies that you will like, such as conditioning some of that aid for Ukraine as a loan, and as well as the TikTok ban bill, which many conservatives do support.
And so all of that, if it does pass, all of that would be then coalesced into one big bill and sent over to the Senate.
That's right. It's a complicated process, but the end result is that the Senate ultimately would take one up or down vote on this entire package.
So I mentioned the TikTok ban is kind of thrown into this last fourth bill.
Yep.
Could that actually happen that, you know, on Saturday night, TikTok is banned as far as the House is concerned?
It's either they have to sell or it's a ban, and it would have to go through the Senate. But yeah, on Saturday night, theoretically, the House will vote it up or down on that TikTok ban. Of course, they have already passed it previously as a standalone bill. We could end up in the situation where Saturday evening they've passed it again, and it will be on track to pass in the Senate at that point.
Okay. All right. So it sounds very delicate and complicated. And what is the likelihood that any or all of these bills will pass?
Well, look, I think the entire premise of this structure that Speaker Johnson has created is that he is trying to cobble together enough votes from mainstream Democrats and mainstream Republicans to push all four pieces of this across the finish line. The idea of separating up the aid bills for up or down votes would allow, for example, a conservative Republican who opposes Ukraine aid to register their opposition to aid for Kyiv, but allow them to vote yes on Israel. And for example, a liberal Democrat may choose to vote against the aid bill for Israel and vote for the Ukraine aid bill. And so you're going to see a lot of shifting coalitions when it comes to the votes on the floor on Saturday night. And his hope is essentially that he will be able to cobble together the votes to push this all across the finish line. He was certainly going to need help from Democrats, and it is going to be a very tenuous stance. But what we're hearing is that there's a lot of optimism among both Republican and Democrat leaders that it will work.
Okay. And you mentioned Saturday. He promises a vote Saturday night.
He has told lawmakers to expect a vote on the floor on Saturday night. Of course, this has all been very fast moving. It's very complex. That may change, but that is the latest guidance.
Okay. Meanwhile, as we mentioned in the intro, there is this push to perhaps remove him from his speakership, led by Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. She now has an ally in Thomas Massie of Kentucky. He's also joined her. And so how realistic is it that they could actually succeed in removing him if he brings this up for a vote?
Well, the answer may really depend on what Democrats choose to do, because there is such a thin majority in the House that Republicans have. really what Democrats decide to do becomes sort of the operating force of whether or not the Republican speaker can stay in office if Republicans choose to try to oust him. Of course, we saw that happen when Democrats chose to vote with some ultra-conservative Republicans to oust then-Speaker Kevin McCarthy. But, you know, we're hearing very different things from Democrats this time around. Democrats previously have both been privately saying, and in some cases publicly saying, that if Speaker Johnson did, quote unquote, the right thing by moving to help Ukraine, and Republicans tried to oust him for it, some Democrats have said that they would vote to save him in that instance. And sounds like we will have a very different situation on the House floor if that vote comes to pass than we saw for former Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
And that would presumably happen, if it does happen, after Saturday, after the votes?
We will see. Now, after those votes, we're expecting House Republican leaders to gavel out. The House was actually supposed to leave for recess Thursday night, so they're going to want to go home as quickly as possible. Once Congresswoman Green decides to call a snap vote, Republican leaders have to allow that vote to come to the floor within 2 legislative days. Now, that's different than calendar days. That is days the House is in session. So that could punt a vote down for another week or so.
And is there anyone waiting in the wings? Does anyone want this job after everything that we've seen happen to McCarthy and now Johnson?
Well, that is a real question. I mean, we obviously know that it took several weeks for the House Republican Conference to find Speaker Johnson as a willing candidate, someone who could get the votes to become Speaker. I think, of course, in Washington, D.C., there's never a shortage of ambitious lawmakers who are looking to move up the ladder. But it is certainly a source of huge frustration for a lot of mainstream and even some conservative Republicans who simply do not want to have to go through another tortuous process of finding a new leader, taking potentially multiple votes to find someone. After Congressman Massey said that he would join the effort to oust Speaker Johnson, I overheard one Republican frustratedly saying to another, "Why don't we see if Daffy Duck can do the job?" There's a lot of anger.
Is there a world in which a Democrat, namely Hakeem Jeffries, the leader from New York, is there any way that a Democrat could win the speakership?
Even some ultra-conservatives like Congressman Gates has been warning, you know, if that snap vote to oust Johnson was called at a time when there were more Democrats just in attendance on the House floor than Republicans, that it could end up leading to a Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. That would certainly be kind of a wild and anomalous outgrowth of that situation, but it is a possibility hanging out there.
Well, we've seen a lot of wild and anomalous things lately on the House floor, so who knows? Katie Edmondson covers Congress for the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
In the federal government, it looks like there will be new sanctions on Iran after last week's unsuccessful attack on Israel. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says that could come in the next few days, as we also wait to see how Israel will respond to last weekend's unprecedented attack. We're going to look now at how the people of Iran are feeling about all of this. Joining me now is Benjamin Rad, a professor of law and global studies at UCLA, where he focuses on Iran. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, just today, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi warned that even the tiniest invasion, quote unquote, by Israel would bring a, as he calls it, massive and harsh response. And so, of course, Iran and Israel have been enemies for quite some time, for many, many years. And the leaders are backers of Hamas and Hezbollah. What do the Iranian people think of all this? Do they agree with the regime when it comes to Israel?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I think one fact that often surprises most observers who are not in Iran is that Iran has the population that is the most pro-Western, pro-American, and a government that is the most anti-Western and anti-American. And what I mean by that is that, by and large, the majority of the people do not support the regime's internal policy decisions or their external foreign policy decisions, including its support for Hezbollah, Hamas, and other Islamic groups who act as proxies. So there is no broad support within, as much as we can discern, because it's not like you can pull them and ask them these questions. But from what we pick up on social media, interviews, you know, conversations with the people that live there, they express their frustration and discontent with the government's decisions.
Including last weekend's big attack on Israel?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen evidence of that on social media. We see subtle forms of protest at sporting events and in public spaces where they simply say they are not interested in war. And this is all happening at the same time as the government is now clamping down on freedoms within the country, such as, for example, morality police going after the women who were not fully covering their hair, being very aggressive about enforcing those laws. It's not a coincidence this is happening at the same time as the government's doing these things abroad.
Right. Okay. So what is happening with those protests? 2 years ago, there were lots of protests after the death of Mahsa Amini. That was, of course, the young Kurdish woman who was arrested by the morality police for not properly wearing her hijab. And then she died in custody. And of course, there, as we all know, there were widespread protests after that. Hundreds of people have been killed in these protests and thousands, tens of thousands arrested. What's happening now?
Well, now, we obviously, the protests that we saw a year ago, 2 years ago, have subsided. And that's in large part because the government's been very effective at curbing those protests. They've been very aggressive in arresting, detaining, imprisoning, torturing, killing whoever they need to. This government, this regime came about. It was born out of protest in the 70s, late 70s, 77, 78. So they know very well the power of allowing protests, of what happens when they go unchecked. And so they were very quick to get in front of it last year, as they were when this happened with the Green Movement protests more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And then there was an election last month, which saw the lowest turnout since the Islamic Republic was founded in 1979. Official numbers say 41%. I don't know if you can trust those official numbers, but still 41% is pretty low given Iranian history. And so what does that tell you?
What it does is it undermines the argument that this government, that this parliament, this presidency has any public legitimacy and public support. And for so sort of one argument Iranians like to make, or the officials like to make, is that they do have elements of a democracy, that they have a democratically elected parliament and a president. But of course, you know, most candidates can't get on the ballot. They get removed based on a Guardian Council's decision, which is this sort of unelected body of clerics that's only accountable to the supreme leader. So candidates that the public would want are not allowed to run. And the public sees basically these elections as nothing more than theater. And for them to not vote is an act of civil disobedience and protest against the ruling elite.
Is there a generational divide in terms of support for the government?
Absolutely. And it's not even, the majority of the country now, upwards, I think 70%, if not higher, were born after the revolution. So for them, they have no ties to any of the ideology that fueled the protests in 78 that led to the overthrow of the monarchy in 79. So they have no allegiance, no attachment, and no buy-in to the current system whatsoever. And that's where we see a large segment of the public protest happening, especially around the Mahsa Amini murder.
Okay, well, talk a little bit about the effect of sanctions, because Iran is already under very punitive sanctions and the economy is in deep recession, inflation near 45%. It's hard to imagine that. We're complaining at inflation at, 3 or 4% here. So do Iranians blame the regime or do they blame the West for the state of their economy?
Yeah. And again, a large part of the segment, from what we can learn and we can discern, they absolutely do hold their leaders accountable. They understand that there's all this money being spent on external adventures and programs, you know, supporting these proxy groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen. These all take tremendous amount of money. And the question is, where is this money coming from? Why is it being allocated to serve these interests that don't serve the needs of the Iranian people? So by and large, they do not hold the West responsible. Nevertheless, their conditions are miserable. The quality of life is incredibly low. Depression, drug use, suicide rates, all of these things are issues for Iranians, especially the youth. But yet they know where the heart of the problem is. They just can't do anything about it.
So what would any more sanctions look like?
Well, at this point, sanctions could be targeting individuals, individual leaders. Mm-hmm. It would be targeting Iranian banks probably even more. But already there's not a whole lot that can be done that hasn't been done. What has to happen is sanctions have to come from other countries as well. Isolating trade further, sanctioning anything that basically is considered non-essential. So, you know, right now, the Iranians are able to get around U.S. sanctions. They work with other countries. There's a complete black market operation. So sanctions from the U.S. alone will be insufficient to really have the dramatic effect. Right now, it is much more symbolic because, like you said, they've done as much as they can do.
Okay, so Iran's supreme leader, who basically calls the shots, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, he's 84 years old. So what happens after he either steps down or dies and he's no longer in power?
There's going to be a fierce battle for who succeeds him. I mean, if it were up to him, it would be his son, who he's been grooming for the last 10, 15 years to take that position. But he doesn't enjoy unanimous support. There are various factions within the assembly of experts that ultimately decides who the next leader will be. So there's a lot of these very old men. I mean, let's be candid. They're all old for the most part, vying for that title and that position. And nobody has emerged as sort of the strong leading candidate for that. And so there will be chaos. There will be a lot of uncertainty. And I think it's a decision that they're hoping to defer as much as they can and not have to face.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and explaining all that.
Thank you for having me.
That's Benjamin Rad, professor of law and global studies at UCLA. Coming up, near Oakland, the only federal prison for women west of the Rockies is closing after a sexual abuse scandal. So where will the imprisoned women go now? Later on, also, we will talk with Sarah Koenig about the latest season of the podcast Serial, where she reports on the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Those stories coming up next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Our next story may not be appropriate for young listeners, so just a warning there. We'll be talking about sensitive topics inside a women's prison. The Federal Bureau of Prisons announced this week it'll close the women's prison in Dublin, California. That's about 25 miles east of Oakland. That prison has had problems with overcrowding, with medical care, with aging facilities that have mold and peeling lead paint. But its most notorious problem, sexual assaults of inmates by prison staff, including the warden and the chaplain. It's been so bad, the prison has a reputation as a, quote, rape club. 8 employees were charged with sexual abuse. 7 have been found guilty, including the former chaplain and the warden, who got a sentence of nearly 6 years. The Dublin facility is the only federal women's prison west of the Rockies. The actresses Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin were sent there after they were convicted in the college payola scandal. Since the announcement that the prison will close, inmates and their families have been expressing concern about what happens next and where they will go. Joining us is LA Times reporter Carrie Blakinger. She's also author of the book Corrections in Ink about her time in state prison. Welcome back to Press Play, Carrie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, you've been corresponding with one woman there who was imprisoned in Dublin. And tell us what she told you about what it's like there and what happened after it was announced the prison would be closing.
So I've actually spoken to a number of women who are currently there or have been there. And some of the just general conditions, aside from the issues of abuse, are still shocking even by prison standards. I mean, there's the asbestos and the mold. The crowding is really, I'm saying, next level for a prison. Just some of the cramped conditions that people have described, and the sort of pattern of hiding it whenever oversight authorities need to show up, has really stood out to me. But obviously, the thing that the prison is most notorious for at this point is sex abuse. And I think that right now, when you hear all of that, one of the things you might assume is that if they're announcing a prison closure, that this is good and that, you know, people would be eager to get out of there. But it's actually a little more complicated than that.
Right. Because where will they go? And were they told where they might go?
No, I mean, there's a limited number of options. I've had some sources say that there's some folks that might get transferred to facilities that are not only for women. So some folks might get housed at Victorville or Seattle, but most folks are expecting that if they are not released, they'll end up someplace that is hundreds of miles from home, because as you mentioned, this is the only women's only federal prison that is west of the Rockies. So any place these folks are going is going to be a lot further. And as is typical for prisons, they don't tell you where you're going in advance. Mm-hmm. So it's just a lot of anxiety and wondering and not knowing how many hundreds of miles you're going to be from your family or your kids, and you know, how that's going to impact your ability to maintain those important family ties.
So the judge who is overseeing this has said that there needs to be some, you know, consideration taken in terms of how the women should be transferred after objections were raised. And what did she say?
Oh, this was so interesting to me. So the prison started to transfer folks. And then I had several of the women at the prison tell me that buses of people were coming back. They'd had to turn around because of this order from the federal judge. Shortly after the Bureau of Prisons announced the decision to close, the federal judge held a status conference and then issued a ruling saying issued an order saying that these women couldn't be transferred until they were evaluated for possible release, like who can potentially go to a halfway house or home confinement or, you know, be granted compassionate release. So that definitely changes the timeline of things. The women at the prison said they'd been told that everyone would be cleared out by Friday. Now, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has not officially or publicly said that. They've said that for security reasons, they won't say what the timeline is. But this is what the women were told. And that seems to be clearly not possible now if all these cases need to be reviewed for possible release before folks can be removed.
So is the prison being closed in response to this sexual abuse scandal and the, you know, the federal investigation as well as the lawsuits?
I mean, one might reasonably conclude that. And I think you can read between the lines of the department of the Bureau of Prisons statement and gather that, but they haven't officially connected those dots. And some of the women reported that they were told things like that they were just being moved due to the asbestos. But the timing does look mighty suspicious, because this was, I think, less than 2 weeks after a special master had been appointed to oversee the prison. So the timing does make it look as if there's a connection there.
So many scores have filed, have joined a lawsuit against the federal government, against the prison. What exactly, or maybe not exactly, but broadly, because we don't want to get into too much detail, happened there when it came to the sexual abuse scandal?
So, I mean, there's a variety of allegations. I mean, that I've had a number of women that I've talked to that have described, you know, just sort of routinely witnessing sexual assaults. One of the things that is not the most serious of the allegations, but one of the things that just stood out to me as to how brazen this all was that the warden was accused of having sexually explicit images of women on his bureau issued cell phone. And that to me was just clearly, again, not as serious as some of the other things, but that really speaks to the brazenness and the degree to which these men believe that they could behave with just complete impunity.
Right. The chaplain was involved, which was another shocking detail. So there are these there's a lawsuit as well as federal investigation. And so I imagine that this could go on for quite some time, the legal action.
Yeah, I feel like there's so much going on with this entire case, entire scandal in general, that it's almost hard to keep track of. But yes, there are multiple lawsuits. There's some individual lawsuits, and then there's also class action. And, you know, a lot of this focuses on the sexual abuse, but there's also some other conditions related issues, you know, because, again, some of the other things I mentioned, you know, medical care, asbestos, mold, overcrowding, that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a number of different legal issues at play here. And, you know, it seems like even after there are major occurrences, you know, arrests and wardens getting, you know, repeatedly replaced, even, you know, several years into this, there was still, you know, a few weeks ago that the FBI showed up to raid the facility, which was, I think, remarkable. So it just seems like everything has happened that you can imagine, like something else manages to happen. So to me, it seems really unclear how long this will all drag out.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Carrie Blakinger, LA Times reporter who covers the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. Coming up, Sarah Koenig of Serial is here to talk about her latest season. It's all about the prison at Guantanamo Bay, a place open to house the so-called worst of the worst in the war on terror.
I feel like Guantanamo is sort of like the mother of all examples of like what we claimed our intentions were and how far we fell in fulfilling those intentions.
That conversation is next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 10 years ago, a little podcast changed everything. Millions of listeners got hooked on Serial, the investigative podcast about Adnan Syed, who was in prison for killing his high school girlfriend. It was the first podcast phenomenon with more than 80 million downloads during its first season. Serial is now in its fourth season, this time telling the story of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp.
Chaos. Simply put, it was chaotic.
You think your Allah is going to help you? You think your Quran is correct? You know, it's a bunch of garbage. It's a
Rights? What rights? Nobody knows you exist here.
This season tells the stories of some of the people imprisoned at Guantanamo and some of the people who worked there, the guards, interpreters, media handlers. It's been long enough now that some people felt free to talk to Serial's reporters, one of whom is Sarah Koenig, who's here now. Hello.
Hi.
Well, so this prison opened, well, about as long as my daughter has been alive, has been open for 22 years or so. And you tried to report on it a decade ago, and you couldn't. So why couldn't you back then report on this?
Well, we could. It just wasn't interesting. Because we couldn't. So the story we were trying to do, we were trying to make it season two of Serial. So this was back in 2015. And we thought, you know, this was a year before Obama was leaving office, President Obama's last year in office. And he, as some people might remember, he had promised his first year in office to close it down within the year, mm-hmm. he said at that point. And lots of people did get transferred out and cleared out during his presidency. But there still was this last year left. And we thought, okay, there's going to be a scramble to try to close this place down before he leaves office. Let's see what happens. Like, silly us, not realizing, like, there was 10 years to go on the joint and possibly definitely longer, because here we are. And it was just nothing was happening. And nobody could talk freely about what the place was and how it felt to be there and how it felt to work there. And I mean, for personnel who were running the place, it just, they were so careful and so tight that we just got all this really terrible tape, like really boring tape. And then we were finding, by far, the best conversations we were having were off the record. They would say, can you just turn that off for a second? You know, they turn off your tape recorder. And they'd be like, okay, here's what I want you to know, but I can't say it. And so that, it was just like incredibly frustrating.
So you gave up on it and did a couple of other stories. And then you returned to it. Because people now could talk, they weren't working there anymore. They had, you know, the advantage of time to really look back on it and think about what happened.
Right. Yeah.
And also nobody cares anymore, it seems. Like, no one ever talks about Guantanamo.
I know. I mean, a lot of it was people being out of them, especially military personnel, right? Like, while they're in uniform, they just can't talk openly. So it was a lot of people just leaving the military, retiring, or going into civilian life. But also, I think you're right. I think there is this sense of like, eh, who cares? Like, all this, you know, everybody knows what went on there now. And like, what could I possibly say? You know, I don't think that's quite true, but I do think there's a little bit of a relaxed feeling about it because so much time has gone on and nobody's talking about it.
So at its height, there were 780 prisoners, right?
Yeah, they were never there all at the same time. But yes, all told, 780 men and some teenagers, younger people, mm-hmm. have been through it.
And now it's down to, what, 30 or so?
30.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And will those 30 ever get released? One of whom is the alleged mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Are they there forever, these 30?
No. Some of these men are going through criminal trials there, and the trial of the men accused of planning the 9/11 attacks, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who you mentioned, they're like in the middle of the case, I would say. Mm-hmm. Only now we're in, like, a reminder that we're in 2024.
Yeah.
And the 9/11 attacks happened in 2001. So, you know, they're very far from a trial. Whether or not they'll come to a plea agreement of some kind and settle the case that way, that's still up in the air. So some of the, like, the men going through the court, presumably there is some end game there. But whether or not, for example, if there is some kind of resolution to the 9/11 case, like part of that resolution might be that they stay at Guantanamo forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the men who are not going through criminal proceedings, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. Some of them have been cleared and for release, but we can't find a country to take them, or we're still negotiating with other countries to take them. There are a few there who are just, you know, what the reporter Carol Rosenberg has termed forever prisoners, who have not been cleared, will not be tried, have not been charged with a crime, and they're just law of war prisoners that we can keep for as long as we claim there are law of war prisoners.
So that gets it at what you want to get at, I guess. And why don't you talk about your interest in this place? Because it is, as you describe it in the series, really weird from many points of view. So what was it for you, the sort of the abiding or overriding feeling or question that you had about this place, Guantanamo Bay? And it wasn't just that people had forgotten about it and were moving on. There's something about it that obviously piqued your interest all of these years.
Yeah. This is always the hardest thing I find to articulate, which is embarrassing because it should be really obvious to me. But sometimes I don't even know why. I mean, I think I am very interested. You know, the previous season of Serial that we did, season three, we spent a year and a half or so just inside a felony courthouse in Cleveland, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
just as a kind of like, here's your average felony courthouse. Here's what goes on here. It's pretty broken. Let's see what it's like in a day-to-day way, how decisions get made. And it just learning how, just kind of navigating the gap between how we want our criminal justice system to function and then how it actually functions, like kind of living in that gap for a year and a half, I was just like, holy wow, okay. And I feel like Guantanamo is sort of like the mother of all examples of that gap, of like what mm-hmm. we claimed our intentions were and how far we fell in fulfilling those intentions. And this is just like such an extreme, bizarre, screwy example of just like an experiment gone wrong on such an enormous stage. And then apart from that, right, like the stories are weird. They're weird. It's like they're stories you don't find in any other context because this place is exceptional in so many ways.
Yeah, the way you describe it is so strange. I mean, you've got these young guards and military workers. They're really just maybe fresh out of high school, and they're partying like crazy because they are in tropical paradise.
Everyone's tan and hot. Everyone's drinking and young.
Massive amount of drinking. Massive amount of partying.
I mean, just everyone was getting drunk and getting laid.
And then the Puerto Rican National Guard.
gosh. They had the best beach parties.
And then they go to their jobs, which is kind of like the opposite. So how did they deal with that complete disparity in reality? Like, on one hand, they are guarding who they're being told are the worst people in the world who want to destroy America. And then, you know, when they punch out, they're partying on the beach.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's like everyone every day. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to overstate, but there were certainly themes, right, that people, a lot of people told us about the drinking, and not just the young people. I mean, officers told us about it. You know, older people were saying like, oh, yeah, the drinking and the carousing. It was like, it was legion. You know, the thing people forget about Guantanamo is it's just a normal naval base. It's a naval base. And so there are bars there and restaurants and mini golf and disc golf and regular golf and, you know,
and
like there's just stuff to do. Yeah, it's like a normal place. So they're availing themselves of all that stuff while they're off duty, which I completely understand. What else are you going to do? You know, I would probably do it. So I understand that part. The other part is the job, even for people who weren't having daily interaction with the detainees, the job is shockingly stressful for personnel. Mm-hmm. People were like, I did tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Like, I saw people die. I was in a crash. You know, I saw things I can't unsee. That kind of like really terrible trauma from war. And they were like, Guantanamo was worse. Guantanamo was worse. Guantanamo is more stressful. I have more damage coming out of Guantanamo than I had in those places, because they knew what those places, they understood those places. And it sounds a little like a cliche, but they would say things like, I knew who the enemy was when I was in Afghanistan. At Guantanamo, everybody's under huge pressure. It's such a political nightmare, the place, that all the higher-ups are stressed out. They don't want any news coming out of Guantanamo. All the news that was coming out for so long was so bad. And all that stuff is just trickling down onto the lowest level personnel. Even when their commanders are trying to kind of protect them from it, they were all feeling it. And so I think some of that partying and releasing in a young person's way generally was stress relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally get it. Yeah. Especially when they are participating in, witnessing, or just knowing about what was euphemistically called enhanced interrogation techniques or...
Yeah, I mean, I would say those techniques, which, you know, we would now call torture, I think, pretty in a pretty accepted way. Not everything, but some of those tactics are definitely torture. And those stopped happening after the earliest years. So most of the personnel never participated in those or saw them. So I know it's tempting to be like, everyone's damaged because they saw people being abused. And I will say, like, most of the people we talked to said, I actually didn't see people being abused. And they were still traumatized by the place,
Wow.
Which is more interesting to me.
Yeah.
Right? Because then you're like, well, wait, why? What is it? You know? And there's a guy who's in our first episode named Raul Sanchez. And the way he talked about it, Dana, who's my co-host on this season, Dana Chivas, she interviewed Raul. And he's someone we had met back in when we first went there in 2015. And when he talked about, like, he can't even completely articulate what was so disturbing to him about Guantanamo. I mean, he had a total breakdown when he came home. He's been diagnosed with PTSD from it and all this stuff. And you know, his was just like, it was like the whole place pretending to be something it wasn't.
Yeah, I felt trapped. I felt trapped because I couldn't say anything. I couldn't know. I was now, in that moment, I was now lying.
And it was kind of crazy making, like a feeling of being gaslit, basically, is what he was describing. And just feeling like there's all these people just trying to survive the place and get out.
So what is your feeling of it now that you've done all this reporting? Were your questions answered in any way or not?
I think what I've learned a lot about is our inability to correct our mistakes.
Yeah.
Like, that's the part that I still find a little shocking. I mean, now most of the action there, things that are actually happening, is located in the court at Guantanamo. And you see all of this playing out in a lot of ways in the court, where they are pursuing charges against people in circumstances that it's impossible. You're not going to, you can't succeed. There's no version of success in those cases because the CIA tortured these men. You can't hide people away for 4 years in a black site overseas, disappear them for 4 years, and then take them out of those places, bring them to Guantanamo and say, okay, fresh, clean slate. Let's start over.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to build a criminal case. You can't do it. And so, like, just to see that it's still churning forward, like, that has been kind of shocking.
Yeah. But there's also, I mean, it's a Kafkaesque thing. It's also that they can't return these men to their home countries, right? Also, some countries won't take them. And I guess they're never going to let Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out.
Right. But you could have had a trial in the United States of America in federal court, where we know how to try terrorism cases, and we do it all the time.
Right.
And successfully.
Right. But then their argument is then you can't have any evidence because it was collected under torture. So
you lose the case.
So
but that's our
case.
System.
Exactly.
Right? Like, so who's I don't know. I feel like I'm the trusting one in the system, where I'm just like, surely we care to learn from our mistakes. Surely we would like to analyze them and see where we were wrong. And I feel like it's the government who does not seem to have trust in itself, in our own systems that we had, that were in place, that were perfectly adequate to deal with the situation. And we lost faith in all the things we purported to believe in. I know I sound trite and like I'm on a soapbox. But I mean, that is what happened. That is what happened. And so, like, the mess that you see when you go there, like, oh, okay, this is all the consequences of, in some cases, very well-meaning people, professional people, people who are trying, who want to do the right thing, stuck inside a thing that was broken to begin with.
Well, Sarah, you're quite something. And thank you for all of your work. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks a lot, Madeline. Nice to talk to you.
Sarah Koenig, she's host of Serial. The fourth season is ongoing. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. How sea otters are being repopulated along the California coast. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Sea otters were nearly hunted to extinction in the early 20th century for their pelts. But thanks to conservation efforts, their numbers here in California have rebounded from about 50 in 1938 to around 3,000 today. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has played an important role in this ecological success story, fostering abandoned otter pups for later release into the wild. And now, here in Southern California, the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach is joining the initiative. It has its first orphaned otter. Megan Smiley is the manager of the Aquarium Sea Otter Program. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you. Well, talk about this otter and where you found her or him.
Great question. So our first releasable sea otter pup here at the Aquarium of the Pacific. Right now, her identification is Sea Otter 968. And she was stranded as a young pup just north of Santa Cruz and was brought into Monterey Bay Aquarium and stabilized there. A little bit of triage care from their staff. At which point, because we are their partner in their sea otter surrogacy program, 968 was brought down here in the beginning of February, and we have been helping to rehabilitate her with the help of our adult female, Millie.
So what is Millie doing for 968?
So Millie is acting as a surrogate mother to 968, who's going to teach her all of the necessary skills that are going to be needed out in the ocean. Because ideally, the plan is that 968 will be released back to the ocean, hopefully late summer or early fall.
And what kind of skills is Millie teaching her?
Millie is teaching her how to sufficiently groom her coat, The sea otter's fur coat is probably their first and best defense at staying warm in the cold waters that they live in. And so their fur is super dense. It's actually creating a waterproof barrier between their skin and the water, and it helps keep them warm. In addition to that, Millie is teaching 968 how to manipulate prey items. Here at the aquarium, we are offering a variety of different types of prey for her to practice this. And Millie is showing her how to do it. Millie is bringing her food and offering it to her. And then teaching the pup how to play with the food and really manipulate those shelled items so that she can pull all of the meat and calories out of that prey.
So we always see pictures of them lying on their backs and eating some kind of shellfish thing on their chests. Is that how they eat?
Absolutely. So they're going to dive down to the bottom of the ocean, gather up their prey items, and then bring them to the surface and have more or less a buffet on their chest. And they're going to run through all of that food that they've gathered on the bottom until they are sufficiently full. And then they'll spend some time at the surface grooming that fur again and then having a little rest. And they will repeat that same cycle throughout the day, every few hours, 24 hours a day. Sea otters in general are eating a variety of benthic invertebrates. So a bunch of filter feeders, maybe some different invertebrates like crabs, mussels, clams, even sea snails. One of the most famous prey items of sea otters are sea urchins. And that'll talk a little bit more about the conservation story for them, but and their effect on their habitats.
And it's important for the environment that they're eating sea urchins, right? Because sea urchins feed off the kelp forests, and we need the kelp forests to sequester carbon.
Exactly. So the sea urchins are only really eating the holdfast of the kelp, which if you compared the plant to a terrestrial plant, it would be a little bit like the root system. It's not gathering nutrients from there, but it is grounding the plant in the water. And so when the holdfast is removed or eaten, the rest of the kelp just floats away and dies. And so with these out of control urchin populations, it's just decimating the kelp forest. And you're exactly right. The kelp forests help sequester carbon. During the photosynthesis process, they're absorbing carbon into the plant itself. And then eventually that plant will get washed and buried under at the bottom of the sea. And so it's a great carbon sequestration tool, and sea otters really help to protect that.
And as I said in the intro, there are only around 3,000 sea otters today. Why haven't they rebounded more?
It's a really good question. And scientists are speculating on a few different things. Some of it is that they're having a hard time expanding their territories. And there's a few reasons for that. Number one, recently, in the past decade or so, the climate change has created warmer waters farther north than typically have been found there. And so white shark populations have started to congregate and overlap with the sea otter habitats. And what we're finding is that the white sharks are not necessarily eating the sea otters, but they are cases of mistaken identity. And usually one shark bite is fatal to a sea otter. Some other reasons that they're not really expanding in population is because of some of the kelp forests sort of being degraded, a lot of the biodiversity and food availability for them has changed. Maybe there's not as much prey available, or that they are maxed out on the number of otters in a certain geographic location.
So how important is the foster program? Are there a lot of orphaned sea otters?
There are, on average, between 10 to 15 sea otter pups, southern sea otter pups, that strand every year. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of capacity in the surrogacy program relative to those numbers. So Monterey Bay Aquarium, who pioneered this whole program, has capacity for roughly 4 orphaned otters a year. Now that the Aquarium of the Pacific is online, we also have capacity for 4 sea otters a year. However, if you do the math, we're still short a little bit. And so really our community, we are all trying to work to maximize the capacity of this type of program or sea otter rehabilitation in general, because the need is there and we are trying to expand our programs so that we can help expand some of the natural population.
Okay, so if all goes well, 968 will return to the wild by the end of the summer?
End of summer or early fall is an age-appropriate time for that, definitely. She's 4.5 months old right now, and usually animals get released around 8 to 9 months old. And really, there's not the timeline is arbitrary. We're really looking more for milestones. Can she take care of herself properly? That includes being able to manipulate all sorts of food items. And can she socialize properly? So her next big steps are going to be getting weaned from Millie at around 6 months of age, and then socialized with some other juvenile otters, which would replicate what she's going to experience out in the ocean.
Megan Smiley is the Aquarium of the Pacific's Sea Otter Program Manager. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And that will do it for us today on Press Play. You can follow us on the socials. We are at KCRW. I'm at The Mad Brand. And thank you for listening today. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll be back with you again tomorrow.